This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series.
Right, well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another Bristol Confringe. Hopefully, our little technical mishap is not going to cause too many problems. What I've done is I've put the recording microphone on the mic stand, so if people just talk into it, then fingers crossed it'll be fine, and we'll get on with that with the Q&A. Before I start, I just want to acknowledge, primarily for benefit of people on the podcast, that we are recording this the day after the news broke of the massacre in Orlando. We've been watching some of the reports on the news. It's all been pretty horrifying, I think, for most people. There will be a vigil on College Green tomorrow evening, starting, I think, at 6 o'clock. So if anybody can manage to make it along for that, I'm sure that the local LGBT community will be very grateful. We do have a small change to our usual format tonight. Stephanie has a train to catch back to Welsh Wales, lucky you. And so we're going to do her reading first, ask her a few questions, and then take a break, and we'll have Justin afterwards. So in view of that, I'd like to welcome our first reader tonight, Stephanie Burgess.
Thank you very much. Am I speaking the right angle? Fantastic. So I was going to read the first chapter from my latest book. It's called Masks and Shadows. It's my first adult book. I have three children's books out so far. This is my first foray into adult historical fantasy. It's set in 1779. Begins Act 1. Chapter 1. Did I tell you Nico's invited a castrato to stay? What? Charlotta von Steinbeck nearly spilled hot chocolate all across her silken sheets. She tightened her grip on the ridiculously fragile, overpoweringly expensive cup and sighed. Her sister had done it on purpose. She was certain. Sunlight streamed in through the open windows of Charlotta's guest bedroom, sparking off the gilded leaves that edged every blue and white surface and turning her sister Sophie's unpowdered blonde hair into an utterly incongruous halo. Oh, I suppose we ought to call them a musico to be polite, but you know what they really are. Sophie's eyes glinted with mischief over her own raised cup. She sat on the edge of Charlotta's bed, pressed against Charlotta's knees with easy familiarity, despite the many years they'd spent apart. I've heard this one slept with half the grand ladies in St. Petersburg. Half the gentlemen, too, according to some gossip. Never mind, I don't want to know. Charlotta set down her cup carefully on her bedside table. Sophie had been teasing her all throughout the past week, ever since Charlotta had arrived at Esterhazy. She had to learn to hide her chagrin, or she'd be tarred as the naive country mouse forever. When had her younger sister grown so sophisticated? Still, Charlotta couldn't help giving in to curiosity, even if it did allow Sophie to lord it over her even more. I thought that was illegal now, Charlotta said. Doctors aren't allowed to perform the operation, are they? You've lived in Saxony for too long, Lotta. Sophie took a long, luxurious sip of chocolate, sending the lace-trimmed silk sleeve of her negligee sliding down her fair arm. Oh, they aren't allowed to say that's why they're doing it, but in Italy, they have all sorts of marvelous excuses. Bitten by a swan, fell off a horse. She paused, raising her eyebrows innocently. Aren't you thirsty anymore? Not really. Charlotta topped up her cup anyway with hot cream from the silver vase that stood on the little tray her maid had brought her. She needed sustenance to keep up with Sophie nowadays. Not for the first time. She wondered whether it had really been a good idea to accept her sister's invitation. The offer had seemed so appealing when it had arrived in a gilded letter overflowing with scented ink and kind words. After 12 long years apart, she would finally be with Sophie again, and in a refuge far from Saxony, her overbearing stepchildren, and the chilliness of her new widowhood. A home equally appealingly that was far enough from her calculating, manipulative parents in Vienna that she might escape their new marital schemes for a year or two while she rested and regained her confidence. Best of all, it was the palace of the greatest magnate in Hungary and therefore an eminently respectable option. From the moment she'd first arrived, it had been made abundantly clear to Charlotta that she had been wrong about that last point. Ah, well, Sophie abandoned the teasing with a shrug. We should have beautiful, beautiful music at any rate. Signor Morelli is rated very highly. Nico's Kapellmeister is positively bouncing with joy at the news. Herr Haydn? Charlotta brightened. Have you actually spoken to him? The concerts have been heavenly. I've played his sonatas so many times. I would love to meet him. If he ever has time... He's only a musician, Lotta. If you want to meet him, then Nico will command him to attend you. Sophie rolled her eyes. Honestly, the way you talk, it's a good thing you aren't in Vienna with Mama. You'd be eaten by the wolves there. Or by Mama, Charlotta murmured into her cup. For a moment, their laughter mingled. It couldn't last, though. The memory of their mother only brought the specter of her disapproval into the room. Charlotta couldn't meet her sister's eyes. The one name that Sophie had never mentioned since Charlotta's arrival was the single name Charlotta had most expected to hear. Charlotta's own husband had been too ill for her to make a long trip to Vienna for Sophie's wedding to Friedrich von Hüllner 3.5 years earlier. Charlotta had read reams of description from her mother, though, who had been more than contented with the match and eager to pass on all the details of their new in-law's social standing. Charlotta had received even more letters when Sophie was invited to live at Esterhazy as a lady-in-waiting to the Princess Esterhazy, while Friedrich took up an honorary post with the prince. Charlotta had never imagined, in her weeks of jolting coach travel across half the empire, that she would arrive at Esterhazy to find her brother-in-law mysteriously absent, and her younger sister publicly ensconced as Prince Nicholas Esterhazy's acknowledged mistress. New visitors should liven things up, anyway. Sophie yawned delicately and rose to her feet in a flutter of lace. I must be off, Lotta. Dinner is in only 3 hours. My maid hasn't even started on my hair yet. She narrowed her eyes at her sister. And as for yours, I'm sure I'll find something to occupy my time. Charlotta matched her sister's stare evenly. She might indeed be a widow, crossed into her 30s and living on her sister's lover's hospitality, but Sophie was in error if she thought her older sister could be bullied into complete submission. Of course, Sophie murmured. Perhaps you can practice your music. Perhaps. Charlotta took another deep sip of chocolate as she watched her sister waft out of the room. She could almost feel the weight of soft draperies lifting off her. The end of her marriage, despite all its attendant grim misery, had felt as if it might signal her awakening, at last, from the long and clouded dream that her life had somehow become. Even now, Charlotta often felt herself only half awake, as if some indefinable essence had disappeared or wasted away from lack of use, and she no longer knew how to regain it. Still, she knew enough to see that she'd never find her own way again if she allowed herself to become only her sister's latest toy. This palace could far too easily become a gilded prison. And now Castrato is coming to stay. Charlotta shook her head ruefully as she set down the chocolate and rang for her maid. Esterhazy was anything but what she had expected. Scene break. This is wild country indeed. The English traveler, Edmund Guernsey, lifted a scented handkerchief to his nose and leaned away from the carriage window with a shudder. I wonder that you gentlemen would brave such dismal surroundings for pleasure. The smell alone is torture. Carlo Morelli, the most famous castrato in Europe, looked out his own window at the clusters of straw huts that dotted the harsh brown landscape. In the distance, high walls surrounded Esterhazy Palace, home of the wealthiest nobleman in Hungary. The contrast was instructive, to say the least. Only 2 nights ago, in Vienna, an idealistic young poet had ranted at Carlo for an hour about the wonders of the shining new enlightenment that would soon make all of Europe a paradise. That news had plainly not yet reached the Esterhazy serfs. The men and women who worked outside looked like skeletons, digging hopelessly for roots in the dry, arid ground, their thin frames bent by the wind that swept across the plains. Carlo had never seen such wretched poverty, even in the village where he'd grown up. Yet it was only the smell of the pig's filth that bothered Guernsey. Across from both of them, Ignaz von Born let out a short laugh that twisted his thin, ascetic features. You'll find Esterhazy rather different from the rest of the Hungarian plains, my friend. It is quite the Versailles of our empire, apart from the Empress's own Schönbrunn Palace, of course. Every prince has his own Versailles nowadays, Carlo said quietly. I've sung in most of them. And better, I'm sure. Guernsey leaned forward eagerly. You've sung for the Sublime Porte in Constantinople, have you not? Carlo leaned back slightly, keeping his fixed smile, and the Tsarina in St. Petersburg. A happier choice. Von Born fixed Carlo with his glittering gaze. Our co-regent, Emperor Josef, is none too happy with the Turks these days. Really, Carlo said. I thought he'd be happier than ever now they've displayed such weakness before the Russian armies. The gossip in St. Petersburg was that he and the Tsarina together might well carve up a new Ottoman Empire for themselves, if only they can create an expedient political excuse to do it. You're in Habsburg lands now, my friend. Von Born wrapped his bony hands around the elegant, ornamental walking stick that he held even while sitting in the carriage, an odd affectation for a man who seemed otherwise uninterested in fashion. I would judge your words well. Yet I'm no Habsburg citizen, and music knows no borders. Carlo met his gaze and felt, more than saw, the flinch that ran through both men at the high, sweet tone of his voice. A freak, it was how most saw him. Every bone in Von Born's aristocratic body probably felt the twinge of repulsion, yet his face retained its normal hauteur. Guernsey, on the other hand, Carlo had met his type too often to be surprised anymore. That sort of man couldn't hide the fascination that matched the repulsion. Left to his own devices, he would probably ask to see if there was still a scar left from the operation all those years ago. Carlo thought back to the scarecrow farmers toiling outside. Better to be a freak and fated by kings than to lead that life. If his parents hadn't listened to their village organist and taken the risk, he might well be dead by now of starvation or any one of the creeping diseases that ran amok in poor farming communities. Who would want the ability to bring more children into such circumstances? He met Von Born's gaze full on and smiled gently. Von Born might be an aristocrat, but Carlo's voice had carried him into greater palaces than the old man's noble birth ever could. Von Born coughed and looked away. Is this your first visit to Esterhazy, Signor Morelli? It is. You'll find it a wonderland of culture after this dreary countryside. He raised his walking stick to gesture at the massive building taking shape before them. Operas and concerts beyond compare, and one of the finest art collections in the world. And are you in here on business or pleasure, Herr von Born? Carlo asked gently. Von Born stiffened. I beg your pardon? Our friend Mr. Guernsey is writing his book of travels, are you not, sir? Beside Carlo, the little man twitched. It has been my dream for a long time to surpass Dr. Burney's memoirs. He wrote well about music, but he could not understand the cultures. Indeed. Carlo kept his lips firm with an effort. Guernsey, if that was indeed his name, must have worked long and hard on his English accent. It was exceedingly rare to find a German native who could mimic it so well. Carlo, though, had spent a year in London singing at Kew Palace and at the Haymarket Theatre. He would swear, on his kingly salary there, that this little man had never set foot in England in his life. King Frederick of Prussia had spies already scattered throughout most of Europe. Had the Esterhazys attracted his rapacious attention now as well? So, Carlo inclined his head politely to the aristocrat across from him. We have all, I'm sure, heard stories of your amazing feats of alchemy, sir. I only wondered whether your trip was purely for pleasure, or if you were planning a, shall we say, professional retreat? Von Born's lips thinned. The philosophical quest is a matter of passion, sir, not business. Much like the pursuit of great music, I would imagine. Of course, Carlo murmured. He noted to himself, however, as the carriage slowed, that von Born had refrained from answering his question. The title of alchemist covered a multitude of sins in Carlo's experience. Von Born presented himself as a natural philosopher and student of mineralogy, and in earlier life had become famous for his scientific experiments. Yet his fingers, now wrapped around his ever-present walking stick, no longer displayed the telltale stains of laboratory work. Perhaps his passions were leading him in other directions nowadays. We've arrived. Guernsey nearly bounced in his seat. Esterhazy itself. Marble pillars soared high into the air around them. Uniformed servants pulled open a wrought iron gate to reveal the palace itself opening before them. Esterhazy's golden body and front wings formed three sides of a giant square, enclosing a front courtyard filled with rippling fountains, a wide reflecting pool, and classical statues that gazed coolly down at the approaching carriage. Carlo leaned back in his seat and smiled as the golden walls of the palace closed around them. The most notorious alchemist in Europe, and a probable Prussian spy, rode in the carriage with him. This might well be an interesting visit after all. Scene break. Inside the walls of Esterhazy, at the end of a corridor through which only the most trusted servants were allowed, a plume of dirty gray smoke escaped under the crack of a closed door. It rose up into the air, twisting and contorting until it formed a snake-like, coiled mass. Deep within its roiling center, eyes opened and flashed red. Its gaze fixed on the end of the corridor and the opening that led to the rooms beyond, uncoiling, it flowed forward in a smooth, predatory glide. Inside the room, a deep voice began to chant. The words rolled out, following the smoke down the corridor. It twisted and turned, fighting their grip. The voice hardened. The smoke lurched gracelessly backwards, still struggling. It clung for one last moment to the ornately carved beveling around the bottom of the wooden door. The voice rapped out a single word. With a hiss of anger, the smoke released the door and disappeared into the room.
Alrighty, well, thank you very much, Stephanie. That's absolutely fascinating. I guess I should probably start by begging for a reminder of the history, because there's obviously things going on in the background between the Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. So could you please enlighten us as to which particular historical events we should be expecting?
Sure. Well, this all came out... I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this. Several years ago, I started doing a PhD at the University of Leeds, and I was studying opera and politics at the end of the 18th century in Vienna and Esterhazy. And I spent 3 years doing it, and I have no PhD thesis, but I do have this book. So, you know, it all worked out. And I guess related to stuff that's referred to in this chapter, I would say that what I was particularly studying for my PhD thesis was the way that opera was used as propaganda, and because Emperor Joseph was trying to whip up support for a war against the Ottoman Empire. And so he used opera as one of the techniques, you know, get these, operas out there about these evil Turks and so on. You know, much the same way propaganda has worked throughout the centuries. But actually, of course, this book, it ends up being more about the conflict between the emperor and his mother, the empress, and the nobles, because this is the Enlightenment. There was movement toward, you know, more liberation for the middle classes. I wouldn't say the lower classes. And the nobles were very much against this, while the Habsburg emperor and empress were very trying to push it forward, push this sort of liberal agenda forward. And at the same time, what was also going on in Vienna at this time period was there were a whole bunch of secret societies, really interesting secret societies. And there was a whole bunch of what they called alchemy at the time. And it's really difficult when we look back at that now, because trying to differentiate all the different pieces, because some of what they called alchemy is what we would call science. You know, there was the mineralogy, there was the, you know, studying the way the world worked, you know, and trying, you know, the whole quest to transmute lead into gold. You know, people actually ended up finding out amazing things along the way. And then there were different kinds. There were some people who were actually holding these salons that were almost like seances. And it comes up in my book where they talk about summoning these elementals from beyond the veil. And that actually became from Sir Isaac Newton, had this theory of there was our world and there was the ethereal world and there was this sort of veil, you know, separating. If we could just figure out how to pull it apart. You know, this was actually a serious, you know, serious people we consider very important scientists in history were trying to work this stuff out. And then, of course, there were also some con men at the same time who were trying to trick people, you know, in the same way that, you know, professional kind of ghost hunters in the 19th century did at seances. So these things all get mingled together.
Yeah, lovely. I mean, my next question was actually going to be about alchemy, so you kind of preempted me on that. And it's lovely you brought Newton in there, because Newton, of course, was a very keen alchemist. Mm. But you're talking about secret societies as well. I guess we're sort of venturing into Illuminati territory, aren't we? Yes, because, I mean, they're Bavarians, of course, rather than Hungarians, but it's exactly the same sort of thing. And what, the Carbonari in Italy, would that be? Yeah, so that's all part of the same thing. So lots of lovely secret societies, always good material for books. Yeah, okay, so opera as propaganda, absolutely fascinating. Are there any specific operas that you can refer to that were used as anti-Turkish propaganda?
This is the embarrassing part where we realize how many years of having parenting and young children, and it's been a long time since my PhD thesis. However, let's see, some of the ones that I particularly studied, whereas Armida, I loved Haydn's Armida, which was, again, written for Esterhazy, performed to Esterhazy, about this basically a Middle Eastern witch or sorceress who seduces the crusader, Rinaldo. And very unusually for opera, usually at the opera, the evil woman dies, and sometimes she just dies out of nowhere. I mean, there's one Wagner opera where basically you never really know why she dies, and she just sort of falls over at the end. But evil women don't survive. And but Armida, you know, at the end, Rinaldo's companions come, they save him, and then she sings this furious opera, this furious aria, I should say, about how she's going to seek revenge, and she takes off on her chariot with the dragons pulling it, and that's the end of the opera. And I think, wow. So,
yeah. Presumably she flies away cackling, "I'll get you, Rinaldo, and your little dog Toto too." Wonderful. Good. Yes. Nothing like a good wicked witch. I love that. Anyway, I have one other question, which should be fairly obvious, which is about castrati. I've done a lot of historical research about eunuchs, and it's quite fascinating in that, you know, we have this idea that they were all you know, innocent victims, horrible things were done to them, they were exploited and so on and so forth. But already in your book, we've seen that Carlo has used becoming a castrato as an excuse for escaping poverty, essentially. We know from the writings of people like Casanova that many of the castrati identified as gay. It was a means of having a gay lifestyle. And it would not surprise me in the slightest if there were not castrati who identified as trans women in some way, because, hey, that would be the obvious way to do things. So can you share any of your research about their lives at all?
Sure. And just to make it clear, because I know it didn't really come up in the first chapter, but yes, my castrato hero, who, by the way, ends up with Charlotta at the end. You know, there is. Sorry. I think it's implied. I think it's implied in the back cover. So I think this is clear there will be a romantic relationship. But however, I would also say that, yes, you know, in fact, the rumors are very true. He is bi, as many of the castrati were. And it's very interesting, because the way I got interested in writing about castrati, which I'd already heard about, you know, studying musicology, studying opera history, was I came across an article which is about all of the different court cases that were fought during the 18th century about whether or not castrati could get married. Because actually, this was like the equivalent of the fight over gay marriage, and right down to the fact that exactly the same arguments were being used. The Catholic Church said no, over and over again, they said no, castrati may not marry because they can't have children, and marriage is only for children. And again, this came to court because again and again, couples wanted to get married and, you know, were brought down. And then in England, the Church of England originally said that they could get married. But then there's a very famous case near the end of the 18th century where they got married, and then a few years into it, I can't remember exactly how many, something like 5 or 6 years into it, the wife decided she wanted to marry someone else, and so she went to court and got it annulled on the basis that it could never have been a real marriage, and it completely ruined it for everybody.
That is absolutely brilliant, because that's exactly what happened to April Ashley. So it's a complete mirror of it. That's brilliant. Thank you so much. I need to know more about this.
Having said all that, that was my entryway. It was, you know, thinking about, you know, this whole issue and just all the stuff that comes out of that. And that being said, absolutely, the castrati were the rock stars of the 18th century, far more so. You didn't get superstars in the same way who were male non-castrati singers. Even the sopranos, you know, the sopranos could be divas, but the castrati were just head and shoulders. They were the famous ones. They were the ones everyone went crazy over. And they were the ones with the notorious sex lives, you know, the ones that people love to gossip about. And they were the ones who made tons of money, just tons. It was a calculated risk when families decided to do it with their children. Usually the town organist would be, you know, as in my book, you know, some music specialist locally would say, I think your little boy has the potential. and then you have to take a risk because, of course, not just because your voice doesn't deepen doesn't mean you're actually going to be a fantastic singer when you're an adult. So it was a big risk. And so for many castrati, and this is the kind of thing you, of course, weren't going to do if you were already, you know, middle class, upper class, you didn't have any need to take this kind of risk with your child. But if you did, and if you were in poverty and here's this way for your child to potentially get incredible success as an adult, a lot of people decided it was the right choice to make. And it's really interesting as a former musicologist to watch the different ways that people have talked about this over time, because until recently, until I was in college, actually, people were still passing around these really awful, degrading portrayals of what the castrati had been like. And it was partly based on some caricatures that were done in the lifetime, much like they're done of famous people nowadays, and partly based on the fact that, you know, Victorian era musicologists, and then, you know, a lot of the American and English musicologists up through the 20th century were very freaked out by the idea of it. And so they passed around all these things about, oh, and they were always incredibly fat, and they were always, you know, like this bizarre, like, list of, you know, things that were being passed around in university courses is, oh, this is what they were like. And people actually started digging at the end of the 20th century, and they're like, this is nothing. these were the very angry caricatures that were done of them. And in fact, for some reason, I cannot speak to, you know, why this would be if it's true, but it seems to be from contemporary descriptions, the castrati tended to be taller than average. Who knows? You know, they have very broad chests, which let, you know, the music resonate. And that was what created this incredible effect, is they had these very high voices, you know, as high as a woman's voice, but they had their great resonance through their chests. And they're often incredibly attractive people.
I don't know about risk, but even with a voice as bad as mine, I'd have been queuing up. But there you go. Does anybody have any questions that they want to ask Stephanie while she's still here? Justin, yes.
Very interesting, Stephanie. It brings to mind a little story from a film I was watching the other day, The Last Emperor, which is about the last emperor of China in the 20th century, from about 1919 to 1960, 1970. wonderful film. But anyway, there's a part in it because the young emperor is brought up by eunuchs. And of course, China has got a lot of history with eunuchs, some of them being emperors themselves and warlords and all the rest of it. And there's one point where the young emperor is like flexing his adolescent muscles and realizes that his temple finances are being ripped off by the eunuchs. So he kicks them all out. And there's this really poignant scene. I'm sorry, it's a bit of a spoiler, but there they are walking out of the Forbidden City with this little box in front of them. So there's these guys standing up on the castle kind of watching what's going on. And one of them says to the other, what are they carrying? So he turns to him and says, well, actually, it's part of their manhood. Because when they die, they want to be buried whole. Really poignant scene. Wonderful to see. I don't know if you've seen the film, have you? But clearly a lot of history there about that whole kind of castrata thing as well. But yeah.
Yeah, Admiral Zheng, the Chinese admiral who led the naval expeditions into the West and, until he was hauled back by the emperor, was a eunuch. And Cai Lun, the Chinese bureaucrat who's credited with the invention of paper, is also a eunuch. So lots of good eunuch history in China. Stephanie, anything you want to add to that?
I would just say, actually, brought up by Justin's point about the last emperor, I wouldn't actually necessarily recommend this movie, but there's a soundtrack I would recommend, and it's to the movie Farinelli, and the movie is about one of the famous castrati of the 18th century, and I don't love the movie, but I love the soundtrack, and the soundtrack, they did this fantastic job using musical technology to try to replicate the sound of what it would have been like for, you know, a castrati to sing, which is something that none of us really knows, because the only recording there is in existence of any castrati was done of one who was so old at the time, it's impossible to guess, you know, what his voice would have been like in his prime. So this, the soundtrack to Farinelli, it is on Spotify and Amazon Prime and so on, is worth listening to.
Any other questions? Lots. Joe.
Yeah, just because obviously you've studied music for your whole life and you kind of poured music into this book. How did you rein it in and stop it being 5,000 pages long? And how much fun was it to write?
Possibly by not massacring everybody like you did.
I make no promises about not massacring. It was enormously fun to write. Obviously, it was more fun than my PhD thesis, which is why I have one more and not the other. Actually, what I did was 3 years into the PhD thesis, I had a first draft of this, and I had a job at an opera company. it was so much fun to be able to pour in all this stuff I really love. And it actually came from, at the time when I first came up with this book, I was living in Leeds, and my landlady was Justina Robson, and we lived down the street from each other, so we would have tea a lot of days when we didn't want to write. And one of the things she said was, why don't you ever write about music since it's what you're actually interested in? You know, you're spending all this time reading out for hours and day in the library, why are you not doing something with it? Because none of my stories or books had anything to do with music at that point. So this was the book where I took Justina's challenge and I just poured it through. If you notice, it begins act one. It's a three-act book, like a three-act opera. It's structured similarly with the different characters coming in and out, having the finales at the end of each act, really huge one at the end of the last one. And yeah, and I even, you know, this is not going to matter to any reader of the book, but for me, because I'm an opera geek and I studied Haydn's operas, I got to make up a Haydn opera in this one, so it made me happy, and it kept it down to 100, no, how many is this one? It was somewhere between 80 and 90,000 words, and the sad thing is I don't remember for the edited version exactly how much it turned out to be. I'm just not a big fat fantasy reader, so I'm not a big fat fantasy writer. My husband adores all the big fat fantasies, and more power to him, but it's not me. So,
sorry about that, Joe. You can chastise me afterwards. Pete, you had a question.
I do, yes. So Obviously, this is all set in sort of the Habsburg Empire. How did you go about studying that and bringing it alive? Did you actually go and visit some of the places there in the book as well?
Yes, I spent 2 years living in Vienna for various different periods. And then while I was doing the PhD thesis, I got another grant to go back again, which is great. Actually, my one bitter regret was that I was supposed to go out to Esterhazy that last time. I got it all arranged and it fell through the last day, and I'm not exaggerating. I sobbed. I was so upset. So when it came to actually Esterhazy itself, the palace, this sounds really pretentious to say it this way, but it's really important in the book. It's almost a character in the book. It's very important. So what I did was I read book after book, and I read all these travelers' accounts that detail about the peasants outside looking like scarecrows while everyone's inside, you know, feasting. That came straight from a traveler's account from the 18th century. Luckily, a lot of English and German travelers did go out and, you know, write about what they'd seen there. And I scoured maps and I did all this stuff. And then about 2 months before this went to print, I had a friend actually go to Esterhazy, and I was like, send me photos. So, yes. So lots of time in Vienna, virtual time in Esterhazy.
Any more questions? Well, in which case, let's thank Stephanie once more for a fabulous reading. There are copies of the book available to buy if you want them. Other than that, we'll take a short break for people to replenish their glasses, and we'll reconvene with Justin Newland.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.